HBpodcraft.com.
The thunder of my old-fashioned door knocker, reverberating eerily through the house, roused me from a restless and nightmare-haunted sleep. I looked out the window. In the last light of the sinking moon, the white face of my friend John Conrad looked up at me. "May I come up, Kirawan?" His voice was shaky and strained. "Certainly." I sprang out of bed and pulled on a bathrobe as I heard him enter the front door and ascend the stairs. A moment later, he stood before me, and in the light which I had turned on, I saw his hands tremble and noticed an unnatural pallor on his face. "Old John Grimlin died an hour ago," he said abruptly.
Slowly, almost imperceptibly, my bathrobe opened.
"Go on," I said.
Why, he doesn't say that.
No, I was just adding that to that the end of the reading. It seemed appropriate.
Yeah.
That was just an addition for me, but that wasn't the actual story. What was that actually from?
Well, that ominous opening, and somewhat kinky now, is from Robert E. Howard's Dig Me No Grave.
Yes.
And this is the second story of this month that we are affectionately calling Thulai.
Thulai.
All Howard. All month.
It's summertime fun with an angry Texan. This story appeared originally in Weird Tales in 1937.
Mm-hmm.
It's also been published as John Grimlin's Debt. Mm-hmm. I think Dig Me No Grave is a better title, though.
Oh, heck yeah.
When I was reading it, I actually penciled in a third variation by adding some punctuation to the title so that it read, "Dig Me? No? Grave." Like that.
You know who I dig?
Who?
Today's reader, Anthony Tedesco.
Yeah!
He's back, baby.
Yes, Tedesco is a talented voice actor, and you can check out more of his work at his website, which we will link out to. You can also catch Anthony live this August. He'll be appearing drunk and shirtless on the rooftop of the Panorama City Walmart, just shouting nonsense. But great projection, great enunciation,
yeah.
You know. He's the real deal.
A professional.
By the way, when I was making up that lie about Anthony, I wasn't totally sure that there was a Walmart in Panorama City, so yeah. I wanted to check on the veracity of that. So I typed it into Google, and the autocomplete in the search bar said, "Walmart Panorama City haunted."
What?
So I checked it out, and apparently that Walmart, there was an elevator accident when it was a different store in the 80s.
What?
A 15-year-old was killed, and now up on the third floor of that Walmart, strange things are said to happen.
Wow.
Merchandise falling off the shelves, apparitions.
Oh.
Some otherworldly deals on socks. I thought that was interesting. It's just the kind of situation you'd want some supernatural investigators to check out.
Yeah.
Like in the story.
This week's story features the characters John and John, John Conrad, and John Kirwan.
These guys are the quiet and bold of Robert E. Howard. Feels it's like every one of these writers has got to have their own spooky investigators, I guess, and yep. these are his.
This info isn't in the story about these characters, but I just wanted to share it with you anyway.
Yes.
So Professor Kirawan is a member of a titled Irish family and a scholar of the mythos who has been all over the world. And he is a descendant of Sir Michael Kirawan, a medieval knight. He also studied with a man called Yosef Vrolok.
Vrolok's off the tongue.
In Budapest, and Vrolok wanted him to do some dark, dark magic, but he wasn't down with it. So, in revenge, Vrolok used his dark magic to turn Kirawan's love against him, and then he debauched her?
Oh, dear.
Which I don't know exactly what that means.
I think when you debauch somebody, you get them into some kind of a vice, but then they also like the vice, so they, you know, they're not pure anymore.
I see.
So he got her drinking, and then she's an alcoholic. I think it probably is sexual in nature as well.
Probably.
All this information, by the way, is coming from another of Howard's stories called The Haunter of the Ring.
He later joins with something called the Wanderers Club, which is a group of people that adventure and know strange mythos type lore. These characters are all directly connected to Conan as well.
To Conan?
Yeah, to Conan the Barbarian.
Wow.
Via the magic serpent ring of Set, which belonged to Thoth Amon.
Well, between these two, I think Kirwan is the more important John.
Yeah.
I mean, that's who you're describing here, and he's right. Definitely got the cooler name. Whereas John Conrad, even though he narrates, or, you know, he gives a lot of the information in the story, he seems to be more of the Watson, the assistant
right,
type.
Right.
But Kirwan's the narrator here.
Kirwan is the narrator.
Yeah.
Howard actually features these guys in 7 different stories.
Well, one of them is Children of the Night, which we actually covered a couple of years ago, and I didn't remember that. But
oh,
Kirwan
really?
Was in that story, yeah. I don't think Conrad was, but Kirwan definitely was. I know that story was some of the old snaky underground people.
Oh, right.
Kind of thing. We're actually going to get more of those snaky underground creatures this month.
Nice.
But not in this story. This is a little different. Let's get into it.
The story starts off with John Kirwan snoozing. Kirwan, he sounds like some kind of Jedi or something, doesn't he?
Yeah, totally sounds like a Star Wars name. Or a delicious, like, Japanese beer.
When Kirwan is awoken, I'm going to just quit calling because they're both John. And actually, the third guy is also named John as well. So we're just going to use last names. Kirwan is sleeping. He's awoken just after midnight by his buddy, Conrad. Mm-hmm. Seems that this guy, John Grimlon, John, died.
Everybody in the story is named John.
Kirwan asks if Grimlon was ill, to which Conrad says he wasn't really, but he did have these seizure-like fits, during which he would gibber terrible curses and black blasphemies.
So basically allergies.
They speculate that it might be a hereditary issue, or he might have picked up something on all of his world travels.
Some hereditary taint. The phrasing is so funny. This story is very firmly in Lovecraft world in all ways. So, like, whereas I might say, yeah, this guy died, there was a family history of heart disease, very sad. But Conrad says, he doubtless fell heir to some ingrown weakness brought on by some loathsome disease, which was his heritage from perhaps a remote ancestor. Like, it's such a complicated way to say something that's just basic medical fact. Oh, you know? I hope Conrad isn't a doctor like Watson and sees patients. Can you imagine? Like, tell me, ma'am, do you have any loathsome diseases in your family? Perhaps in a remote way? Relatives who've had sexual relations with gorillas? Hmm? Have you? Even when you were really drunk? I had a doctor ask me that once during a physical.
If you've had sex with a gorilla?
Not a gorilla. It was just funny that he goes, have you had any unprotected sex with prostitutes? I said, no. In the last year? You know, I said, no. He said, even when you were really drunk? And I was like, no. But what a weird leading question. Does he think that I go, anything I did when I was really drunk isn't that didn't medically happen, so I won't report it? The other thing is, like, what did the guy, when he looked at me, he goes, yeah, seems like a pretty mild dude, but I bet when he's really drunk, he gets up to some unprotected sex with prostitutes. I can just tell by looking at him. Anyway.
So Conrad goes on to say that Grimlon made him a promise not to get any medical help as he watched him die. He said that this death was the most fearful death he'd ever seen. And Grimlon screamed and he made this terrible ruckus. As he died, it says, Grimlin's fright was greater and deeper than the ordinary fear of the beyond shown by a man of ordinarily evil life. So Kirwan goes on to say that it was rumored that Grimlon sold his soul to the devil in his youth, which, of course, Conrad took as hooey. Because he was such a creepy jerk, Conrad was Grimlin's only real friend. Like, nobody really wanted to hang out with this guy because he just liked talking about black magic and creepy stuff.
Kind of like us.
Yeah. So to which Conrad says that their friendship was based almost entirely on their shared interest, which was mostly the occult.
Mostly. Well, I think it was their only shared interest, which is why it was such a strange friendship.
Right.
Unless it was like one day they were poring over some ancient forbidden tomes and Grimlon looked up and he was like, wait a minute, Conrad, is that a Tom Selleck tattoo on your neck? OMG. Look at this teardrop under my eye. Look really close. See? It's actually a little Tom Selleck. Here we're wasting time talking magic when we've both been Tomcats this whole time. We have more than one interest. None of that happened, though.
Grimlon was into dark stuff. It said he was into devil worship and voodoo and Shintoism. And I thought, Shintoism? Isn't that the national religion of Japan?
Yeah.
Well, I looked up Shintoism, and it's pretty benign. I mean, there's some magic-y kind of stuff in there, like most religions have. But equating it to the evil of devil worship is pretty nutty.
But it is polytheistic, right?
Yeah.
I know that there are all types of Shinto, but it embraces the idea of spirits occupying the natural world, trees, the sun, animals. So from a Western monotheistic POV, I think that paganistic or scary.
But come on, devil worship?
He does. He groups it in with what he calls foul arts and sciences, which is pretty, you're right, that's pretty nutty. It's not wholesome like our American religions where we gather to drink blood and eat flesh.
Oh, right, of course.
It's not wholesome like that, yeah.
And he digs on voodoo as well, which isn't inherently bad either, and stems from a mixture of Christianity and African religions.
Yeah.
Bits like this kind of, I feel, show that Howard was really just some guy from Texas who never really had any formal education. Mm-hmm. He read a lot, but some of the conclusions that he came to were pretty off.
Oh, that's definitely true. I don't know if this segment reflects any type of personal conclusions. I mean, I think he was a pretty smart guy. For the time, voodoo and Shintoism, they sound exotic. Mm-hmm. Plus, they're also real things.
Yeah.
This speaks more to the intelligence and experience of the reader than the writer. He knows that if he brings up Shintoism and voodoo, they won't know what that is, and that'll sound creepy. Do you know what I mean? So yeah. It might not be that he thinks they're that way. It's just that he knows the reader's going to. The kids who are reading weird tales. I mean, the Shintoism thing's definitely weird. It seemed off to me, too. But I was just thinking that maybe he'd found some dark Shinto path you're not supposed to be following.
Could be.
You commune only with the dark spirits.
So Kiko Man finally asks what Conrad wants.
Kiko Man.
And he says that he needs help taking care of the body. And it seems that Grimlung has some very complicated instructions for what to do on his death. Kirwan just goes and gets ready. No further questions asked.
I know. If you came over and you said that to me, there would be a little bit more of an interview. You know, what do you mean we had to prepare this body? And I'd be killing time anyway just so I could keep my robe open longer. Definitely would talk more. It seems like they're all neighbors or something, too, because once Kirwan puts on his roller skates and his halter top, it says he dressed hurriedly, so I assume he just grabbed whatever was close by. It says they walked up the road, and there was Grimlin's house, so it's just like up the road.
Yeah.
It says there's the house perched like a bird of evil on the crest of the hill, bulking black and stark against the stars.
Kirwan asks if Conrad thinks Grimlin was mad. And Conrad seems to think on this for a few moments, and then he finally answers. And he goes, you know, I think, except for one instance, he seemed like the most sane person ever. Which is crazy, because I know a lot of sane people. I don't know who I would say is more or less sane. You know, it's not, I can't really equate, you know, like a numeric value on sanity. But if any of them ever did, like, one thing that made me think that they weren't sane, I don't think I would still call them sane. You know what I mean? Like, it's a pretty big butt to throw out there. Like, for example, let's say, you know, oh, Chad Pfeiffer, he's the most sane person I've ever known, except for that time that he showed up in a gold lamé underpants covered in cheese whiz and went to the police station screaming for guns. He just wanted all the guns they had.
But
besides that instance,
tip-top brain.
Chad Pfeiffer is the most sane person I've ever... besides that, he's the most sane person I've ever known.
Yeah, it's a strange... The definition of not being sane would be having one little break with sanity. That's enough.
But Conrad goes into a story about the one and only time he wigged out. Mm-hmm. They were up late talking about black magic, and then he just got weird.
He had discoursed for hours on his favorite subject, black magic, when suddenly he cried as his face lit with a weird, unholy glow. Why should I sit here babbling such child's prattle to you? These voodoo rituals, these Shinto sacrifices, feathered snakes, goats without horns, black leopard cults, filth and dust that the wind blows away. Dregs of the real unknown, the deep mysteries, mere echoes from the abyss. I could tell you things that would shatter your paltry brain. I could breathe into your ear names that would wither you like a burnt weed. What do you know of Yog-Sothoth, of Kathalos and the Sunken Cities? None of these names is even included in your mythologies. Not even in your dreams have you glimpsed the black cyclopean walls of Gotha, or shriveled before the noxious winds that blow from Yoggoth. But I will not blast you lifeless with my black wisdom. I cannot expect your infantile brain to bear what mine holds. Were you as old as I, had you seen, as I have seen, kingdoms crumble and generations pass away? Had you gathered as ripe grain the dark secrets of the centuries?
This year at Ozfest, these Shinto sacrifices, feathered snakes, goats without horns, and the reunion of black leopard cults. Tickets on sale now. There was a lot of awesome gobbledygook in that passage. There's that Cthulhos.
Yeah.
Is that Cthulhu? I wasn't sure, so I looked it up.
I'm not sure.
Cthulhos is an Atlantean sorcerer.
Oh.
The titular character of Robert E. Howard's story Skullface, which we have not read.
Oh, wow.
A fan of Weird Tales had written to Howard asking if Cthulhos was derived from Cthulhu, and Howard mentioned this in a letter to Lovecraft. Lovecraft liked the thought and replied that he might adopt the name into the mythos in the future. Which he did, because it appears in The Whisper in Darkness as Lemur Cthulhos.
Oh, whoa.
Also in a passage of tossed off weirdness in that story.
Yeah.
And here, in this passage, Yuggoth is mentioned as well, so it's all connected.
So after he goes on this tirade, he notices that Conrad is completely freaked out, and then he laughs at him, and he talks in this weird voice, and he says, "Methinks I frightened ye, and certes, it is not to be marveled at, sith ye be a naked salvage in the arts of life, after all. Ye think I be old, eh? Ye gapping lout, ye'd drop dead were I to divulge the generations of men I've known."
Uh-oh, oldie-timey talk.
Then Conrad just gets freaked out, and he runs away.
Yeah. So hilarious. I mean, I've been with some people who freaked me out before, but I've never just turned and ran, you know, run away off into the night.
No, I mean, you might make an excuse like, oh, I just remembered I'm supposed to meet my girlfriend, shoot, like 10 minutes ago. I gotta go. Yep. I'll see ya. You know? You don't just run.
I'm gonna try that next time. This passage is golden here. It says, "Some days later, I received a letter apologizing for his manner and ascribing it candidly, too candidly, to drugs. I did not believe it, but I renewed our relations after some hesitation." Like, is it, I guess he's just saying it's merely candid to mention that he was on drugs. But I was like, how is it too candid? I mean, was he like, "Look, man, I was on heroin at the time. By the way, I do that with a suppository. I've enclosed a Polaroid and be doing it. Have a long look."
Yeah, that's too candid.
That's way too candid. Because you know, if it's a Polaroid especially. Cause
that means that it was in his hand.
Yeah. Ugh.
So Conrad asks Carol Wan if he knew anyone that ever knew Grimlon when he was young. And he, of course, doesn't. So Conrad says he asked the people in the village where they lived about him. And they say that he arrived 25 years ago and that he looked the same. Another guy, Von Bonk, says that he knew Grimlon in Vienna, and that was 50 years ago. At that time, he also seemed to be about 50 years old.
Shit, dude, this story is freaking me out! It's pretty obvious what's going on here.
So Kirwan says Von Boenk is 80 and probably just confused because he's an old dude and he gets confused about when people were doing things, to which Conrad just kind of shrugs. They get to the house. It's very dark, and it has no gas or electricity, so they have to use a candle to light the place.
And as they enter the house, Kirwan hears this ghostly beat of a bat's wing. It's mentioned several times throughout the story. There's a bat out there somewhere.
They go upstairs to the library where Grimlon died.
There's a really cool passage from when they're on the way up. It says, "Somewhere above our head, the lone master of this grim house was stretched out in his last sleep, silent, his white face set in a grinning mask of death. Panic swept over me and I fought for control. After all, it was merely the corpse of a wicked old man who was past harming anyone. This argument rang hollowly in my brain like the words of a frightened child who was trying to reassure himself." I thought it was genuinely good.
There's some good passages in here, but as I get to the room, Conrad pulls an envelope from his pocket that contains several pages of yellowed parchment and another smaller envelope. Conrad explains that Grimlon gave him these documents 10 years ago and told him to follow the instructions no matter what he may say in the future.
That is such a terrible thing to ask of somebody. Because what if you really do truly change your mind?
Mm-hmm.
It's like Kato in the Pink Panther, who he keeps attacking Inspector Clouseau.
Oh, right, yeah.
Like, wait, I don't want to do this anymore. I told you that if I ever said don't attack me, that I didn't mean it. But seriously, I don't want to do this anymore.
I would never do that. That's not something...
It's just a weird thing to put on somebody else.
Conrad says that he saw Grimlon lie writhing on the floor in pain as he was dying, and he told him to burn the papers, but he decided to stay true to his original word.
He didn't take the tack that you would have taken.
Yeah.
He goes, even though that guy in his as he was dying begged me to burn these things, nope.
Now remember, you said no matter what you do. But Conrad says that the instructions tell him to place his corpse on the great black ebony table in his library with 7 black candles burning about him. The doors and windows are to be firmly closed and fastened. Then, in the darkness which precedes dawn, I am to read the formula, charm, or spell, which is contained in a smaller sealed envelope inside the first, of which I have not yet opened. Those are his instructions. Conrad also says that the house is left to someone called Malik Tos. And Kirwan gets all, whoa, Malik Tos?
I've never heard that name before. It meant nothing to me.
No, I had to look it up. Though it's Howard's version is probably a bit different than the actual myth. He is a peacock angel of the Yazidi people, which are like this ancient people from Mesopotamia, as in like they're still around, but their religion has been around for thousands of years and they're very secretive about the details, but of course some of the details got out. There are these seven angels that created the world, and one of them is Malik Taus.
I see.
But of course, Kirwan says that Malik Taus is a demon, a devil of the worst kind. Mm. Besides the document saying to give the house to a Yazidi god, it also says, dig me no grave, I shall not need one.
I guess that means that his body will not be available.
I thought it was because he was going to come back to life.
I did too, yeah. Like this was going to be a ritual to preserve his immortality.
Yeah.
He has to do every 50 years or something like
that. Yeah, exactly.
I wasn't sure. By the way, Dig Me No Grave is also, of course, a death metal band. They're from Russia.
Oh, what? Really?
Yeah. They're out there. That's not a joke.
Before they get on with their creepy business, Conrad starts looking around for some booze. But mm-hmm. what he finds are some very old parchments. Family info on Grimlon, which is from around 1500 and earlier.
Yeah, that this whole scene is kind of a dumb coincidence, you know? Like, before we do this ritual, I'd like a drink. I know Grimlon kept some wine in here. Oh, what's this? Documents that explain everything?
Yeah.
Hmm.
One document he finds is on John Grimlon, spelled differently. Mm-hmm. Born in 1630, died 1930. On the document is a black wax seal with a peacock on it. Then they are freaked out by it because it's a peacock. Because yeah. remember that god that he yeah. let, he's the peacock god. That's his symbol.
Mm-hmm.
Kirwan thinks that this is some kind of hoax, but to what end? They decide to continue with the instructions. When they go up to the library, they open the door and Conrad drops the candle. But it's no biggie because the room is lit up with seven black candles and the body is lying on that ebony table. The body is wearing a fancy robe with a peacock embroidered on it.
Mm-hmm.
So Conrad is freaked out. He tells Kirwan, I didn't do this. He was just sitting at the desk when I last saw him. But they also realize that they're not alone in the room.
This section I thought was good. It was effective. Yeah. I thought there was going to be this whole scene of them getting the body up on the table, etc. That boom, it's already done when they walk in.
Yeah.
And before we get anything about this mysterious person in the room with them,
mm-hmm.
real quick, Kirwan throws a little shade on Grimlon, even though he's passed away. Says John Grimlon had been unlovely in life. In death, he was hideous. Yes, he was hideous, even though his face was mercifully covered with the same curious silken robe, which worked in fantastic bird-like designs, covered his whole body except the crooked claw-like hands and the bare withered feet. So he's basically like, he's so ugly, he's ugly even when his face is covered up. That's how ugly he is.
Chad, I hate to correct you on things, but actually, yeah. he's reading him. That's not throwing shade.
He's reading him. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry.
He's being read.
Oh, because when you throw a shade, you got to give a little bit of a backhanded compliment, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. It's an insult that kind of comes around. It's not a direct insult. If it's a direct insult, you're reading somebody. But if you're kind of complimenting them, but really it's like Chad's a really amazing dresser because he's able to take those shoddy clothes that he has and make them somewhat passable. So, you know, I'm complimenting you, but actually I'm just really insulting your poor choice of wardrobe.
I mean, I get it and I'm glad that you taught me that, but it hit a little close to home. But let's get back to this guy in the corner, whatever.
So there's this guy in the corner and he sat in a great armchair in a farther nook of a corner, so still that he seemed to be part of the shadows cast by the heavy tapestries. As my eyes fell upon him, a violent shuddering shook me, and a feeling akin to nausea racked at the pit of my stomach. My first impression was of vivid, oblique yellow eyes, which gazed unwinkingly at us. Then the man rose and made a deep salaam, and we saw that he was an Oriental.
Oh, dear.
Oh, my gosh, an Oriental. Now, when I strive to etch him clearly in my mind, I can resurrect no plain image of him. I only remember those piercing eyes and the yellow, fantastic robe he wore.
The robe that slowly, almost imperceptibly opened.
But dude, yellow robe?
Yeah.
Is this guy a king, maybe?
Perhaps.
A king in yellow? But this guy, he's polite. And he says that they need to proceed with the ceremony. Conrad is now crapping bricks because A, he didn't tell anybody that Grimlon had died.
Yeah.
Which was only a couple hours ago. And then two, the house is locked. Everything was locked up. How did this guy find out that Grimlon died, was able to show up and get into the locked house, and then set up all this doodaddy stuff with the candles and the rope and all that business? But the two Johns are so freaked out, they just do what this guy says, get on with it. The guy in yellow stands at the head of the body with his head bowed down while Conrad reads the text. When Conrad reads, it has some weird droning effect, like kind of a hypnosis. He reads the declarative part of the paper, which says, "I, John Grimlin, hereby swear by ye name of ye nameless one to keep good faith. Wherefore do I now write in blood these words spoken to me in this grim and silent chamber in ye dead city of Koth, whereto no mortal man hath attained but me." And this is all spelled in funny, weird phonetics.
Well, it's not really phonetic. It's like oldie-timey spelling.
Oldie-timey spelling, which I don't really...
I wish it was phonetic, because then it would be easier to read.
Right.
You know, because beginneth is spelled with a Y in it. It's like 17th century spelling, where it says ye, most of the time that's actually the.
Yes.
Remember, because when you see like, you know, ye old teen... tea room or whatever, it's actually the. In old English, people would write TH with a character called Thorn, mm-hmm. which actually kind of looks like a P. But when the printing press came in, since the presses were German and Italian, they didn't have the Thorn symbol, so they used a Y character since it was the closest to the Thorn character.
Right.
And that's why you see ye in places where you would expect the, but it actually is the. Like, that is how you would pronounce it.
Oh, yeah, you don't say ye, you say the.
You would. Now, ye is a word. So, you know, you don't go out and say, hear the, you know, I mean, ye is, does mean you. So in those cases, ye is correct. If you said ye of little faith, it is ye. But for something where it's an article like that,
right.
like here where it says, I do write in blood these words spoken in the dead city of Koth.
Right. So I was mispronouncing it. I should have been saying the.
But the readings that he's reading now are definitely from a few hundred years ago.
And the reading goes between gobbledygook and this bit of the oldie-timey language stuff. As he reads, a candle goes out, which is strange because there's no wind in the room.
Well, there's like a rule that comes here, right? The mortal that gains the black citadels of Koth and speaks with the Dark Lord, whose face is hidden, which I assume is this guy in the room, for a price he may gain his heart's desire, riches and knowledge beyond counting, and life beyond mortal span, even 250 years. And we know this guy has lived about 300, so...
Mm-hmm.
Mortal span is over. So right. He got riches and he got knowledge and he got all that stuff, but time's up.
More weird language stuff, and then another candle goes out, and the guy in the yellow robe, he never moves.
Men see the tracks of the talons, but not yet the feet that make them. Over the souls of men spread great black wings. So there's more of this bat imagery in association with whoever this horrific figure is that a deal was made with.
This goes on as the candles go out one by one. Kirwan is freaking out, but he just can't move or scream because he's just so scared. Conrad approaches the end. His voice is all rough and tired. Approaches now the moment of payment. The ravens are flying, the bat's wings against the sky. There are skulls in the stars. The soul and the body are promised and shall be delivered up. Not to the dust again, nor to the elements from which spring life.
It says, the abyss yawns and the debt is to pay. The light fails, the shadows gather. There is no God but evil, no light but darkness, no hope but doom. Oh, wings in the black dark. And then we get some sound effects.
Kirwan thinks he hears the sound of giant wings.
Oh, red eyes in the shadows. What is promised? What is written? Blood is fulfilled. The light is engulfed in blackness. Yah, Koth. Building to a climax.
The last candle goes out. And a scream breaks the darkness, but it is neither Conrad nor Kirwan who scream. So Conrad finds a candle and quickly lights it. The table is empty. The guy in yellow is gone. The two of them just scream and run all the way out of the house.
So much good running.
As they run out of the house, they stumble down the stairs and spill out the front door.
The outer doorway held momentarily against our frantic assault, then gave way and we hurtled into the outer starlight. Behind us, the flames leaped up with a crackling roar as we fled down the hill. Conrad, glancing over his shoulder, halted suddenly, wheeled and flung up his arms like a madman and screamed, "Soul and body he sold to Malik-Tu, who is Satan, 250 years ago! This was the night of payment, and my God, look, look! The fiend has claimed his own!" I looked, frozen with horror. Flames had enveloped the whole house with appalling swiftness, and now the great mass was etched against the shadowed sky, a crimson inferno. And above the holocaust hovered a gigantic black shadow, like a monstrous bat, and from its dark clutch dangled a small white thing, like the body of a man dangling limply. Then, even as we cried out in horror, it was gone, and our dazed gaze met only the shuddering walls and blazing roof, which crumpled into the flames with an earth-shaking roar.
So a little like the hound in the end there. how in The Hound, you know, they hear the howling the whole time, and then eventually it comes to take its prize.
Right,
he'd been hearing the bat wings the whole time, and then finally swoops in and claims the body. I had mixed feelings about the story, but I liked a lot of the writing.
Yeah, there's some good writing in there. The story is, I feel like it's more kind of a Lovecraftian thing, which I don't think he does quite as well, obviously, as Lovecraft does, and I kind of wish there was more guys punching out things, or, you know,
yeah,
swords,
exactly.
Or, you know, just some more action.
That's true. There's no action in this.
No, there's
this
none.
This is a little different from what Howard usually does, but, you know, I mean, he liked this kind of story as well. He liked building atmosphere.
And, of course. And he's pretty good at it. It's just, it just didn't quite work for me.
Well, he's not as good as Lovecraft at it. So when you do get something like this, it feels a little more like a knockoff and less like what we like from him, which is little of that Lovecraft and then a lot of Conan showing up and fighting.
Yeah.
That's the good Howard stuff.
One thing about the story, though, that kind of stuck in my craw is he wanted him to burn those papers before when he was suffering his seizures and things.
Yeah.
What would have happened if he did burn those papers? That's what I don't understand.
Oh, yeah. The robed figure, is he illiterate or something? Like, why can't he just read the thing? Or even why even read the thing? He's just a big magic evil Satan guy, come grab the body.
Yeah, I don't quite understand what the implication was of not reading it or not going through the ritual. Would something worse happen to him if he didn't do that? At first, I kept waiting for that to be explained, and it never is. So that sort of bugged me a bit.
Metaphorically, this story never opened its robe for you. Next week, we are doing a story called The Thing on the Roof. I don't know if you could pick a more Lovecraftian title than that.
It's pretty great. I want to thank Anthony Tedesco for being awesome.
You are a good man and a good reader. Thank you so much, Anthony.
And I just wanted to remind folks once again that my album Fear Boys with Bugs, which is a new album of old tracks from the 90s, is out now and available on chadpfeiffer.bandcamp.com. For our outro, I will play a track from that record. This is Fever Girl Live.
With that, I am Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to Do You Lie on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
We're here at hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com. Thank you.